And we'll start with, all right, and we'll start with our blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher bachar banu mikol hamim V'natan lanu et torato Baruch atah Adonai Noten haTorah. This week's Parsha is Parshat Pinchas, which begins on page 877. Parshat Pinchas is named for Pinchas. That's the name of a person. And he's introduced in the beginning of the Parsha when Hashem speaks to Moshe saying, Pinchas, or as it says in the English, Phinehas, but it's really Pinchas. Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen. So we're going to start in with Pinchas. What is happening, though, is really a carryover from last week's Parsha, the end of last week's Parsha, which often doesn't get our attention because we're so focused on the main theme of last week's Parsha, which was the cursing of Bilam, of the trying to curse the Jewish people, and that Balak had hired. So last week's Parsha of Balak, Balak hired Bilam to curse the Jewish people. We know it was, thank God, wildly unsuccessful, and instead we got the beautiful blessings which we concluded our class with last time. Just as a P.S. to last week, I learned something which I thought was also so interesting that I'd never thought of before. The Jewish people only know about what happened with Bilam after the fact, that while it was happening and while Balak had hired Bilam to curse the Jewish people didn't know that Balak had hired him. And so these attempted curses of the Jewish people were going on while the Jewish people were going about their daily business. You know, I don't know, picking up their man, schmoozing with their friends, learning some Torah. Obviously not that Parsha, but some other Parshas that they were learning. Whatever they were learning, because they only learned up until the time they experienced it, and then they added into it. But they didn't know that this was all going on and that God was thwarting these efforts to curse the Jewish people. So it was an interesting opportunity for us to understand that as we're just sitting here right now, there are all sorts of things going on that we don't know about. Sometimes, like when you hear about specifically with the IDF, we don't even hear about all the bombs that didn't go off or all of the attacks that were thwarted. There's all sorts of things going on that we don't even know about and that we are just sitting blissfully, or not so blissfully, but somewhat more blissfully than we would be if we knew everything that was going on, and that was also part of the lesson for the Jewish people, is that Hashem is watching all the time, Hashem is awake, and that even while we're going about the rest of our business, that we can't be all eyes on everything all the time, because there's no way to know all the plots and plans that different people have against the Jewish people. In the future, we're told that in the future, when Mashiach comes, that our enemies are going to be the ones who are going to really have something to say about the greatness of God, because they're the ones who know everything that they had planned that didn't get to materialize. We'll only know the things that made the paper or made, you know, the Facebook posting or the whatever. We won't know. They'll know because they're the ones who planned it. And so they'll have a greater appreciation for the ultimate redemption and the ultimate salvation. So I thought that was good to think about in these scary times. It's like, okay, it's scary, but it could be a whole lot scarier, and we don't even know the half of it. So Bilam was unsuccessful in cursing the Jewish people, so he has plan B. So plan B for the Jewish people is get the Jewish people to sin so that God will be upset with them. And the best way to do that is through the men. And that is to have the men be seduced by the women of the Moabite women and the Midianite women. And to, you know, come in, come to my tent, have a party, have a drink. And we know that socializing with somebody leads to, when you take in someone's food, you take in their ideas. And so they would socialize with these women, and then they would get carried away physically and sexually, and then pretty soon they were bowing down to Baal Peor and idol worship, and they were full-fledged into everything, and that's when the trouble really, really starts. So we actually have to go back for a moment to pick up the Parsha at last week's Parsha on page 875. So we're going to read just the end of that, because otherwise the beginning of Pinchas doesn't make so much sense and we won't really know what we're talking about. Hedy, would you like to start on page 875?
I'm going to put on my glasses.
You put on your glasses for this occasion? Okay.
Where am I reading?
Page 875, chapter 25, verse 1.
Okay. Israel settled in the
Shittim.
Mm-hmm. And the people began to commit
harlotry
with the daughters of Moab. They invited the people to the feast of their gods. The people ate and prostrated.
It means to bow down.
Themselves to their gods. Keep reading.
Uh-huh.
Israel became attached to Baal Peor, and the wrath of Hashem flared up against Israel.
Okay. Elisa, do you want to continue in verse 4?
Hashem said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people, hang them before Hashem against the sun, and the flaring wrath of Hashem will withdraw from Israel.
Okay, and verse 5 and verse 5 as well.
Moses said to the judges of Israel, let each man kill his men who are attached to Baal Peor.
Okay, so everybody's, this is like very, very, very serious. Okay, they had a court, they took the leaders of the people, and they tried the people who got involved with this idol worship, and there was a capital punishment against them. Okay, we're not going to get involved in do we believe in this capital punishment or we don't. The Torah does under certain circumstances. The next part is what leads to Pinchas's event here. So verse 6, Janice, do you want to continue?
Behold, a man of the children of Israel came and brought a Midianite woman near to his brothers in the sight of Moses, the sight of the entire assembly of the children of Israel. They were weeping at the entrance of the tent of meeting.
Okay, so what is this? They came and brought a Midianite woman. So this was one of the Jewish men came and brought a Midianite woman in front of the tent of meetings, like in front of the shul, and started, you know, having relations with her. Like, just like right in front of Moshe, like very in your face, in front of everybody, with this Midianite woman. It was a disgrace, and this is like everybody was weeping. The people were weeping. That like they didn't even know what to do because the person involved was not some lowlife. It would end up that it was the head, the president, the leader of the king of the tribe of Shimon was the one who was doing this. Okay, so this was like really, really bad. Pam.
Can you help me with this? I mean, you just explained it, but I don't see in the English. So is it in the Hebrew that they were actually, what they were doing? It says that they were near to his brothers in the sight of Moses.
Yes, so he did it with his brothers, so he did it with the other supporters from the tribe of Shimon. This was an in-your-face motion, Aaron and God.
No, I understand.
Oh, you understand what it says?
It just says that he brought,
yeah.
A man brought a Midianite woman. It doesn't say he was having sex with her.
That's what that brought means sex. That word brought in the Hebrew means sex.
What,
yes.
So in the Hebrew
like
it means
sex.
Sex.
Or just like kissing.
Oh, no. There's like full intercourse and they're just going at it. Yeah.
Yeah, the English is so tepid.
What was that?
The English is so you could...
You wouldn't get it in English, but
no.
This is clearly what's happening because because you're going to see Pinchas's response to this. If you're just kind of like chatting and having
a
margarita with somebody, you don't like take the action that Pinchas is going to take. So then we go on to the next part here. Mindy, do you want to continue, Pinchas?
Sure. And this is also how you know that it was going on because
yes, go ahead.
So Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen, saw, and he stood up from amid the assembly, and he took a spear in his hand. He followed the Israelite man into the tent and pierced them both, the Israelite man and the woman, into her stomach. And the plague was halted for the children of Israel. Those who died in the plague were 24,000.
24,000 people die in the plague that comes from the Midianite women and the Moabite women seducing and luring the Jewish men into the sexual relationship, their whole, you know, degraded everything, life, idol worship, the whole thing. This is a huge, huge problem. So, as Mindy just said, the fact the spear goes into both of them, okay, you only can get a spear into two people if they are really, really close together. So there's like shish kebab, okay? So pierce them through in her stomach and through her vital organs because that's where they were, and and killed them. That killing of them, that killing was called a rescue killing. Just as if somebody was attacking people and causing destruction and you kill the pursuer, the one who's causing death, the people involved in this were causing the death of other people because of their leadership and bringing everybody to such an incredibly degraded place. 24,000 people, and then we're going to see that the plague was halted from the children of Israel by this act of violence that was an act of salvation. I mean, we associate violence with being negative, but violence, sometimes you have to use violence in order to establish peace. That's what, you know, that's what happens in a war, law officials. I mean, they'll say, oh, you know, we don't really want to kill anybody. So, you know, the bank robber who just abducted the whatever, you know, we don't, it'd be so violent if we, like, shot you. So we'll just, bye, hope we catch you sometime. It's like, no, you have to stop it in its tracks. And so Pinchas does this, and he is the one who takes the action. I saw hands go up. Janice and then Valerie. Okay.
Well, I just read the commentary, so one of my questions I'll let go. I'm wondering if there's relevance to the number 24,000, because wasn't that the number of...
Very good. The number of students of Rabbi Akiva who died. Good question. I don't know. That's a very good question.
Does it show up other times that you know of?
Not that I know of, and I'm glad you raised that one, but I don't know about that connection of what that signifies.
So the 24,000 were these men, or the men and the...
The Jewish people, who died.
24,000 Jewish people, presumably all men.
I'm assuming so, and I'm not sure if the women got wrapped in, because, you know, once somebody's wrapped in, and then they kind of bring their family in. I'm not sure who all. That's a very good question. Great questions. I don't know. Valerie.
I have two questions. How do you know that the man of Israel is from Shimon? And it says that he followed the Israelite man into the tent. So they went into the tent?
Then they went into a tent. Not into the tent of meeting, but into a brothel tent to kind of carry on. Like a red light district, only they established...
Why didn't they have that there?
They brought it. To bring all the men so everybody could kind of go in and do their thing. Wow. It was like a mass orgy in front of the tent of meeting and with these women. So everything that Bilam was not successful doing through trying to curse the Jewish people beforehand, in short order, through the bringing and the socializing and the tempting and the bringing in the Jewish men into the social scene, got them all off track very quickly. And it just spirals downward. And that is the nature of lust and getting people. It's like, once that's going, people is like, they're crazy, they're losing their heads. It's like, yep, that's right. You lose your mind because you are not thinking rationally, you're not thinking clearly, and you jeopardize everything and possibly forfeit your life in the process, which they did. So your answer to the question is on page 877, the beginning of our parsha. So now we can pick up our parsha and it'll make some sense, because now we're going to learn who was it who was involved, and all of the parties are going to be named. So great lead question for going to the next part. Marcia, did you want to skip?
I'll try.
Okay, great. Wonderful.
Hashem spoke to Moses saying, Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen, turn back my wrath from upon the children of Israel when he zealously avenged me among them, so I did not consume the children of Israel in my vengeance. Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his offspring after him, a covenant of eternal priesthood, because he took vengeance for his God, and he atoned for the children of Israel.
Okay, we're going to read, thank you, we're going to read ahead one more section, and then we're going to come back to this part here.
The name of the slain Israelite man who was slain with the Midianites was Zimri, son of Salu, leader of a father's house of the Simeonites.
Meaning from the tribe of Shimon.
Yeah. And the name of the Midianite woman was Cozbi, daughter of Zur, who was head of the peoples of a father's house in Midian.
Okay.
That's a question. It's unusual. The fact that they named her.
Uh-huh. The reason they named her.
Sometimes they don't name the women.
Well, they name them when they need to. And this one they wanted to point out because she was not like a low-life person. She wasn't like a common person. She was the daughter of one of the leaders of the Midianites, that they were so bent on destroying the Jewish people that they even sent in their own high-ranking daughters to go in to seduce the leadership of the Jewish men. So it said the Moabite men went in to do like the everyday Jewish guys, and the Midianites went in with the higher level, like the aristocratic group of the Jewish men. So yes, it names her because that was significant that she would be sent in. So this was just such an all-encompassing desire to attack the Jewish people. So it names her. Going back though for a moment, when we hear about Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the Kohen. So usually when somebody is named, we get their name of their name and their father's name. That's how we know who somebody is. The fact that it says that Pinchas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, and then it names who was the Kohen, the Aaron the Kohen. It's like, what other Aaron is there at this point? Oh, you mean Aaron not the Kohen? It's like, who? That is Aaron the Kohen. We certainly know this by the end of 40 years, that this is Aaron the Kohen. The reason it names this is for two points. One is that the Kohanim and Aaron are known for what attribute, what characteristic, what personality quality are they known for?
Bless the people.
They bless the people, and they come from a place of love. Okay, when the Kohanim make the blessing of the Jewish people, it says, Be Ahava. That's the blessing they say to this day. This is coming from a place of love. It's coming from a place of peace. It says, Be like the descendants of Aaron, who love peace and pursue it. Seek peace and pursue it like Aaron. So these are not your kamikaze. This is not the kamikaze tribe. This is the Kohanim are the ones who are blessing the Jewish people, who want love, only have love for the Jewish people, and are seeking peace. But it comes to point out to us that there are times when violence is necessary in order to establish peace. The Jewish people are not an anti-violence group. If you can do it some other way, that's ideal. But you don't not be violent in order to restore peace. That sometimes it's necessary. So it points it out for that reason. That where he's coming from is from Aaron the Kohen, the one who blesses the Jewish people with peace. So while it was an act that looks like it was an act of zealousness, which we associate with somebody who's kind of out of control, he wasn't out of control. He was in control, but it was an act of strength and vigor, and he did it quickly, not precipitously, but he did it quickly. He acted quickly and saved people's lives. So he's considered, he saved people, at least.
I wonder, in the first line of the Hebrew, Pinchas' name, there's a tiny little yud between the hey and the...
It's for a reason, and I don't know what the reason is. What's interesting, so I don't know the answer to that. There is an answer,
sure.
But of course, and it says that it's like a little one, but I don't know why. Definitely the rabbi will know. Definitely will know. So when Hashem, again going back to it, says, I am going to give him my covenant of peace. And if he's, this I do know, is that in the Hebrew, 1, 2, 3, the fourth line down, in the Hebrew, the word on the far left is et briti shalom. And you'll notice there's an asterisk there also. So in the Hebrew, in the Torah, that vav of the word shalom is broken. It's a broken line. Now, normally in a Torah, if a letter is not completely whole, it invalidates the entire Torah. You cannot read from the Torah until it is fixed. In this case, this line has to be broken. The vav cannot be a complete line. It needs to be broken, and it's in the word of shalom. So if you have the word shalom, but one of the letters is not the vav isn't missing, but there's a break in it, so it's like that. What does that tell us? What do you think that suggests by having that broken vav in the word shalom? That there's something about the word peace that's a little broken. Okay, and that's because violence it doesn't show up in here in a Torah scroll. In a Torah scroll.
So whenever there's an asterisk, it means that in an actual scroll, the letter written a little differently.
A little differently. Now, in the case of the Shalom, they don't make it different. In the case of that Yud, they did make it different. They did make it that smaller Yud. But in a Torah scroll, that Vav has to be broken, because that peace is a broken kind of peace. Because we just said sometimes you have to have violence in order to reestablish peace. But that's certainly not our first choice. So you're not going to see a broken Vav in the Chumash. You won't see it in the Chumash. It only is going to show up in the Torah. Bernice, did you have a question?
I'm looking at the fourth line down at the word Shalom, and it looks pretty good.
Okay, so no, that's what we were just...
But you're looking at Pinchas.
Yes, we're looking at Pinchas. I mean, we're looking at the word Shalom on page 876. That word Shalom and the Vav looks normal, right?
Yeah.
So that's what we just said, that only in the Torah scroll is it broken. They don't print it broken in here. It's only in the Torah scroll that it'll be broken. And it has to be broken in order for it to be a valid scroll. So in that case, if there was a whole Vav, that would be an error, and that would invalidate it. Okay? Because then you were saying that what Pinchas did was our ideal version of what Shlemut is, of what Shalom is. And we're saying it was Shalom, but there is a little something not 100% great about it. It wasn't great that this had to happen. It was necessary, but just because something is necessary does not mean it's ideal. And he is rewarded for it, but there is a break. However, he gets this covenant of peace, and then he will be also, and it says here, and it shall be for him and his offspring after him a covenant of eternal priesthood. He becomes a Kohen. He is not a Kohen up to this point. The laws of who is a Kohen were a little unusual. At the time, it was Aaron and his sons who were Kohanim. It was not his grandsons. Any grandsons that were already born were not Kohanim. If they were born afterwards, later, then they became Kohanim. But Pinchas was already born. He was not a Kohen. But this, he becomes a Kohen. It's like the joke when somebody goes to the rabbi and says, you know, I'll give you a $500,000 donation, but I want to be a Kohen. And they say, well, you know, why do you want to be a Kohen? He said, because my father was one and I want to be one too. It was like, you're automatically a Kohen. It's like, you can't buy it. Okay, so you can't buy it. And if you're in, you're in. And if you're not, you're not. The one exception ever was Pinchas, who earns kahuna. So he earns priesthood. He earns to join with Aaron of these lovers of peace, because he did create peace, even though it was through this slightly broken way of having to do it through the violence. And it's not just for him. Because you could have said, okay, so reward him, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all of his descendants from then on down would also be Kohanim. It could have been, you know, like Kohen for your life, and then everybody else back to being a Levite. But that's not the case. So we know it couldn't be earned easily, because Moshe, I'm sure, would have loved to have earned to be the Kohen, and he wasn't. But Pinchas is for what he does. And he is the one who, he stops God's, stops the whole plague and keeps more people from dying.
Does that mean the rest of his bloodline is also
the yes.
male line?
Yes, all his male line, because tribal affiliation goes through the father. So all his descendants are also Kohanim. So he's the only grandchild who was alive at the time when Aaron became a Kohen that he gets, literally grandfather, he gets grandsoned in when the other grandchildren didn't. I mean, it's a little interesting. It's not exactly the same, because it carries with it a whole other responsibilities and privileges and structure. But it's similar to creating the family pattern that was different for the tribes. When Jacob, on his deathbed, basically blesses Joseph and says, your sons will be like sons to me. Jacob's grandsons will become sons like to me. And we have the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Those were not Jacob's sons. Those were his grandsons. Those were Joseph's sons. So Joseph kind of goes away as like an official tribe, and instead we get the two grandchildren, and they become tribes in their own right. So this idea of who is what at this point is a little bit more fluid, that there are some modifications that go on in the process.
Can I ask just...
Sure.
All of these names were, it's a different, totally different name. Is that from the Greek or from Roman?
me why he becomes
Phineas.
Yeah.
Why does it say Phineas rather than Pinchas?
I
do not know why it says, I don't know why.
I just remember in the book, as a journal, they were talking about that one guy, was it Joseph Flavius or something?
Yes.
Who was kind of somewhere.
That's different because he really had, but this predates that. So, but the English, why they turn it into Phineas, I don't know, because it's pretty obvious that it's, is it Greek? Phineas is Greek?
I would think so.
Maybe so, I don't know. Some things they change, for example, names that start with a yud, that we would say, why don't they have it like a Y, they change to J. So like Yitro turns into Jethro. Yerushalayim turns into Jerusalem. There's not a J sound. We don't have a J sound in Hebrew. So they put that in the translation. I don't know how that happened. You'd see like, well, we have a Y.
Wasn't it?
What was that?
It was around the 1400s, wasn't it? The J letter got invented by the English printing press.
I have no idea. I mean, they invented the Y already existed, so you could use the Y for Yerushalayim. There's nobody that says it like a J, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure. What was that?
I'd be
hungry. Oh, thank you. My gosh, every time I look at it. Good. Okay, people with the artistic eye, we appreciate you very much because it drives me crazy. But I don't know what to do about it. Now, what's something that's also interesting in here is the Kohanim come, they're a subset of the tribe of Levi. Okay, Levi, the tribe of Levi, the actual first Levi person, and who had a son named Amram, and Amram had Moses, Miriam, and Aaron. Okay, so they're all within the tribe of Levi. The Kohanim become just Aaron and his descendants, and the rest remain Levites. The tribe of Levi is interesting because it has a history with the tribe that's involved in this big problem here, the tribe of Shimon. So who might remember Levi and Shimon being involved in something before?
When they killed the...
Yes. Shechem, right. Okay, during the abduction and the rape of Dinah. Okay, so Levi and Shimon come together and they go in and they end up killing all the people, okay, of Shechem in order to rescue Dinah. And Yaakov, you remember Jacob's not so happy with their violence that they use. The tribe of Shimon and Levi actually go in different directions. It says they did the same thing, but they had different motivations. When Shimon went in to get Dinah, he was going in as a matter of family, like an honor. It was like an honor, I hate to say it, but an honor killing, but not killing the victim like everybody else does, instead killing the perpetrator. He was going like, you violated my sister. This is our family honor, and I'm killing you for that. So it's all about the family. The family is the top priority. When Levi goes in, he's going in as, you violated the laws of God, which do not allow or permit a woman to be raped, abducted, and raped, and forced into a relationship. Those are two very different motivations. One is family first, and family above all. It's a little Godfather-y-like, my family, come hell or high water, versus Levi, which is, I serve God. That's my priority. We see that this goes differently because the Levi'im, the Levites, become the ones who are in charge of the Mishkan and part of the portable sanctuary and serve in the temple. When they go into the land of Israel, they don't even get their own land, really. They're kind of scattered around because they work for God. It says God is their inheritance. I'm like on the God squad. The tribe of Shimon, we see that there's this kind of this lingering quality of family. I do what I want to do for my family, because when it says that Shimon was involved, Shimon's descendants of Zimri was involved in this sin, and it says that he did it with his brothers. It's like his family like surrounded the tent, the brothel tent, to like protect him. It's like, it's my family. Like, we do what we want to do. It's like, that's a very bad direction to go in. So family is important, but it is not more important. It's not above the law. It's not our family and how we want to do it is more important than what God commands us to do. So we find again that we have Levi and a Levi representative and a Shimon representative coming into conflict, not a personal conflict, but coming from their two very different perspectives. And that this comes occurs again with this event and this incident of how we relate. So people, we know that some people's like, if my family's doing something, we're supposed to support our family. Judaism's very big on family. In fact, we're going to continue with that of looking at how important family is, and we value it, and it's critical. But when we don't put our priorities in the right order, then things can go off track. It's like how you get into tribal wars, is that that's a family thing. It's like my family, and, you know, your family, my family, and you get into like almost like a gang warfare. It can really destroy a society when the family is elevated to a place above which it should not go. So this is like how to keep it in the right perspective. Okay, continuing with family in this parsha. So this is thanks to Rabbi David Foreman, who developed this idea. Actually, one of his colleagues did, and I don't remember his name, but it was under Rabbi Foreman's direction. Talks about that this parsha of Pinchas and legacy, because basically what's being created here is a legacy. Pinchas' legacy as a Kohen, of what he does, what he's given, and that's established for him. And what's interesting is the person who is commanded to tell Pinchas that he is now going to be a Kohen is Moshe. If you were going to write the script yourself, what might you have considered if somebody was going to be inducted as a Kohen at this point? Aaron. Now, Aaron has passed away at this point, but it would be maybe Aaron's son, Eleazar. Welcome to the land of the Kohanim. You know, you're part of us now. But Moshe is the one who is saying this. Aaron's line is established. We have something a little sad about Moshe. Okay, we're at the end of the 40 years. Remember, we just switched over to the end of the 40 years, fast-forwarded through everything. We're getting close to the end. Moshe has two sons, but they are never part of the picture. To put ourselves in Moshe's place, of what's Moshe's legacy? Here's Aaron and his sons and Eleazar, the Kohanim and the whole thing, and Moshe, not. Okay, Moshe, what's my legacy? Everyone's preparing to go into the land of Israel. We know he's not going in. And we know that when people are at the end of their life, that one of the things they start feeling concerned about is, what am I passing on to the next generation? What's my legacy? Who's going to carry on my family? Some people, that's like in my family name, my mission, whatever it's going to look like. Who's carrying that on? So this is getting ready to go into the land of Israel. This generation is getting ready to leave the scene. And now we're going to talk about all the different legacies. So we start off with Pinchas. That legacy is created. Moshe is not part of it. The next thing that happens, it looks dry, and I would have overlooked it, but I heard a class that made mention of it, and I thought was so interesting. That was by Rabbi Shalom Rosner. If we turn to page 879, there is going to be, you see in the margin, right under where it says chapter 26, it says the new census. So they're going to take a new census, which kind of makes sense. The census makes sense that they're going to do this before they go into the land of Israel to kind of see who, you know, how many people we've got. We're getting ready to go into the land of Israel. So what's interesting about this census, and you can see it goes on for a couple of pages, and it goes through each of the tribes. But there's something interesting about this census that is different than the census that was taken at the beginning of Parsha Bamidbar. So keep your hand here, but also turn to page... Let's see, let's just go into page 729. So stay here and page 729. And let's look at verse 20. And we're going to look at Reuven, the count for Reuven. And where were we in the reading? Oh, would you like to? Yes. Would you like to read Reuven on verse 20 through 21?
These were the sons of Reuben, firstborn of Israel, their offspring according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of the names according to the head count, every male from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to the legion. Their count for the tribe of Reuben, 46,500.
Okay, so it's a count for the tribe of Reuben. Okay, simply that's the count for the entire tribe. Now, you can let go of that and go back to page 879, and now we're going to count the tribe of Reuben again. And we're going to see there's something different about this count, about the way it is done. So, let's just start. Do you want to continue verse 5 on page 879?
Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, the sons of Reuben, of Hanok, the Hanokite family, of Palu, the Paluite family, of Hezron, the Hezronite family, of Carmi, the Carmite family. These are the families of the Reubenites. Their count was 43,730.
Okay. What's different about what their count, what, about how they are labeling this count?
There's approximately 6,000 less.
Okay, so there's a number difference. What's different in what? It's based on the
sons.
Okay, it's based on the families. Before it was just the total tribe. We didn't have any listing of anybody's children or who's there or who are the major families. It is only now, as they're getting ready to go into the land of Israel, that all of the family groups are named within the tribe. And that's because when they were first starting out in the Parsha of Bamidbar, that was at the beginning of the 40 years. That's when they were going to be grouped by tribe, and wherever you wanted to be within your tribe, as long as you're within your tribe, it didn't make a difference because you weren't in neighborhoods or things like that. You were in your tent within your tribe. But now what's going to happen when they go into the land of Israel? What's going to change? Everyone's going to be splitting up now and going into their private homes, setting up their farms, their ranches, whatever it is they're going to do. Now it's going to be by family. So it changes the way they're counting. It's like they need to find out, need to have a sense more of, like, now we're talking about families. Still within the tribe, but now it is going to be by family. And the Jewish people are built by the Jewish family. That is the core unit. Nothing against the synagogues that have their fundraisers raising money because saying that this is the core of the Jewish people. It is not the core of the Jewish people. The Jewish family is the core of the Jewish people. That is what makes the difference. And this census with the family is what is a hint to us about the how important and essential that is. And here we have another thing where Moshe and Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the Kohen, are taking the census, and everyone's being counted by their children and their descendants, and then there's going to be just, and everybody, all the tribes, everyone, everything is happening, and then we get to the end where we get, we have the count of the Levite families, which all the way continues on page 885, and then we pick it up. And we're going to talk about, in verse 60, we're going to talk about Aaron, because he's one of the heads of the Levites, and it's going to talk about his family. And Joanna, would you like to read verse 60 on 885?
To Aaron were born Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Ithamar. Nadab and Abihu died when they brought an alien fire before Hashem.
Okay, you can stop there. Just going back up, just a verse, we probably should have done this. The name of Amram's wife was Yocheved, daughter of Levi, who was born to Levi in Egypt. She bore Amram, Aaron, Moshe, and their sister Miriam. Miriam is counted in the family she's married to because the count goes according to the tribes, which is along the male line. But do you notice somebody who's missing in there of their children? We had Aaron, and where's? No Moshe. Okay, Moshe's children, not listed. So here's another situation where we have something that has to do with the legacy that's being passed on, and Moshe's descendants are not there. So we had Pinchas, and then we have the count of everybody. And this is like, you know, this is like Nachas. Can you imagine? Here's my family, and here's my kids, and my grandchildren, and this is my whole group here. I mean, it was a census, but it's also a time for Nachas. This is Nachas. And everyone's in on the Nachas, except for Moshe is not in on this. Oh, Nachas is pleasure, deep pleasure of having reached a spiritual goal. It's like when your child gets married, you have Nachas. If you win the lottery, you don't have Nachas. You just have a lot of money. Okay, so, but it's not Nachas necessarily. Okay, so Moshe doesn't have that. Now, the next thing that happens is that the daughters of Zelophehad also come up on the next page, page 887. And they are also coming to us. And it says the daughters of Zelophehad, chapter 27, verse 1. I'm just going to go ahead and read this just because the names are really hard to pronounce, if that's okay. The son of Hefer, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, of the family of Manasseh, son of Joseph, drew near. Okay, first of all, we thought that that was a long description of who Zimri was related to, but now look what we're doing. The daughters of Zelophehad. The Zelophehad, who was the son of Hefer, who was the son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh, of the family of Manasseh, son of Joseph. That's as far back as it ever, ever goes in listing somebody's genealogy. It's like, why are we talking about that? It says, this is to point out, the daughters of Zelophehad are going to come to Moshe saying, we are the five daughters of Zelophehad. He didn't have any male heirs. We want a share in the land of Israel because it's going to be divided up by the families according to the father's name. If you don't have an heir, it's like, if these daughters, like then who, where is it going to go? And they didn't want just to have it be to their, you know, through their husbands of whatever tribe. They wanted to have a share in the land of Israel. This was not just like, we want money or we want the inheritance. Like, we want the share in the land of Israel. And it's coming to say the reason we know that it's specifically, well, first of all, they say this, we want a share in the land of Israel. But their love of the land of Israel is traced back to Joseph. If you remember, Joseph makes the family swear, what? Take his bones out of Egypt and bring them to the land of Israel. I want my piece of the land, even if I'm not alive to see it. The other brothers didn't say that. Joseph, the other brother's bones weren't taken out. Joseph's bones were taken out because he's the one who said, I want to be in the land of Israel. So it says that this love of the land got transmitted through, this was a legacy that Joseph created. And that we're supposed to think about the things that are important to us. Do we transmit them to the next generation? Do our children, does our family know what's important to us? Do we make it so crystal clear that it actually becomes a legacy and an inheritance that gets passed on, that lasts all of those generations down to these Benot Zelophehad, the daughters of Zelophehad, who come to Moshe and say, we want land. It's our father died. He doesn't have any male heirs. We want. So, and it says, why should the name of our father be omitted from among his family? Because he had no sons. Give us a possession among our father's brothers. Moshe didn't know what to do because the laws of inheritance, according to Halacha, go according to the male. So he takes it to Hashem. And in verse 6, Hashem says to Moshe, the daughters of Zelophehad speak properly. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among the brothers of their father. And you shall cause the inheritance of their father to pass over to them. Okay, so this legacy is going to be transmitted to the daughters of Zelophehad into the land of Israel. That says that the halacha is clarified, and through the merit of the daughters of Zelophehad, that they get to make that halacha come to life and to be made public and known to the Jewish people. Again, a legacy question. Here's their father, who's not even alive, and they want the land of Israel. Moshe, we know, is Moshe going to the land of Israel? No. His children? No. We don't know where they are. We don't even know where they are. Okay? So it's like, wow, this whole parsha of inheritance and legacy is like, Moshe is so, so missing from the scene. However, here comes the big, thank God there's another section of this parsha. Okay. Turn to page 889. And Hashem says to Moshe, and then let's pick this up. Pam, would you like to read this? This is a good one. Read verses 12 and 13.
Hashem said to Moses, go up to this mountain of Abarim and see the land that I have given to the children of Israel. You shall see it, and you shall be gathered unto your people, you too, as Aaron your brother was gathered in.
Okay. Now, this statement here is out of place chronologically. Because Moshe does not die in this parsha. We still have the rest of this chumash to go through. Okay, we have the rest of Bamidbar, and then we have the entire book of Deuteronomy. So this statement of Hashem saying to Moshe, go up to this mountain of Avarim and see the land that I have given to the children of Israel, you shall see it, etc. This all happens at the end of Moshe's life. But it's talked about here because it's going to bring up for Moshe, Moshe, this is going to be your legacy. I want you to see your legacy. First of all, you're going to cast your eye on the land of Israel, and the fact that you see it is going to be, you're seeing it is going to give blessing to the land. It says, like, when a righteous person even looks at something, you know, like someone says, like, oh, they gave me the evil eye, you know, and they, like, looked at me funny. It's like, so there's also an eye in Tov. You look at somebody in a good way, through what's the place of bracha, that you can bring blessing to them. It says Moshe, just looking at the land of Israel, brought bracha to the land of Israel, brought blessing. So what is where he is, what he's going to happen now is Moshe is going to he's going to ask Hashem for a successor. He's like, where's my legacy? We need a leader for the Jewish people. And we find a sentence that we don't find so commonly in verse 15, where Moshe speaks to Hashem saying, usually it's Hashem speaks to Moshe saying, but now Moshe saying to Hashem, may Hashem, God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the assembly who can go out before them and come in before them, who shall take them out and bring them in, and let the assembly of Hashem not be like sheep that have no shepherd. So it's like, who's my replacement? My children. Where are my children are not my replacement. It's not my legacy. Who is it? And Hashem says, take to yourself, verse 18, Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom there is spirit, and lean your hand upon him. You shall stand him before Eleazar the Kohen and before the entire assembly and command him before their eyes. You shall place some of your majesty upon him so that the entire assembly of Israel will pay heed. And then it goes on and on. His word shall they go out, and at his word shall they come in, he and all the children of Israel with him and the entire assembly. Moshe did as Hashem had commanded. He took Joshua and stood him before Eleazar the Kohen and before the entire assembly. He leaned his hands upon him and commanded him as Hashem had spoken through Moshe. So we are having this transfer. It's like Moshe gets a legacy now too. And who is his inheritor? Joshua. And Joshua really was a little mirror image, not a mirror, a carbon copy of Moshe. That he was humble. It says Joshua served Moshe all the days of his life. He was the one, if you can pay it, he would come and set up the chairs, make the coffee, arrange the books, sweep up afterwards. Can I get you a Starbucks? You know, like, what can I do for you, Moshe? And he says he attended Moshe. He was entirely humble. He never spoke in front of Moshe, like to answer halakhic questions when Moshe was there. And he absorbed, it says he absorbed Moshe's Torah and his teaching completely so that he was able to be the next link in the chain, which we say at the beginning of Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers, Moshe gave it over, his best Torah went to Joshua. So Joshua becomes his spiritual child. Joshua becomes his legacy. And so the parsha does not conclude until Moshe has his legacy as well. So a person need not have their own flesh and blood children to leave a legacy. Anyone who has come into our midst and who is under, comes into our influence and whom we share that with and who comes to share and carry out the same ideals, that is part of our legacy. That person is part of our legacy. And Moshe is able to do that with Joshua. What's interesting is that the place where this all happens, if you go back, because it's like, why do we need to know this? Go back to the top of page 889. It says, Hashem said to Moshe, go up to this mountain of Abarim. Now, in Hebrew, it's Elhar Ha'Avarim, from the word avar or over, and the word over means to pass over or to cross over. Okay? It means to cross over or to pass over. Now look back on page 887 when we talk about the laws of inheritance, verse 7, about Hashem saying to Moshe about the daughters of Tzelafchad. The daughters of Tzelafchad speak properly. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among the brothers of their father, and you shall cause the inheritance of their father to pass over to them. And the Hebrew word is vaha'avarta, to pass over. So that's the word that's, I'm sorry? That is verse 7.
What's the letter?
Zion. So it is the, it's the second line of that new paragraph in the Hebrew, the last word, vaha'avarta. Vaha'avarta shall be passed over. So this is talking about inheritance of something passing over, of how you give over to another person. And now we have Moshe, where is he told to go? Stand on the mountain of legacy. Stand on the mountain of passing over, and I will tell you. I'm going to first of all have your legacy go on to the land of Israel just through your sight of the land of Israel. Is it passing on your legacy to the land? And I'm going to have you then also take in Yehoshua, take in Joshua as your legacy in Torah and in person. He is like your child, and you're going to share, just like what a parent tries to do. The laws of inheritance are very interesting in Jewish law about the why does a parent give child money? It's like, why does a parent give child money? We'd say, because we love them, we want them to have. But the Torah's definition of why a parent gives a child money is so the child can continue the mission of the parent, of what they were taught in their home. And it's all the resources go to the child so they can continue the mission of the parent. That's the reason for the inheritance. Moshe, it's like, how do you pass that on? So God tells him, you're going to give over your holiness. Your glory is going to pass over to Joshua. You're going to put your hands on him. This is the first smicha. This is what smicha means. To ordain someone is to pass over and to transmit a legacy. So Moshe, this is what you're going to do with Yehoshua, with Joshua, and he's going to carry on your legacy in the land of Israel. And most people feel that even if, you know, they don't want, nobody wants their life to come to an end usually if you're feeling healthy, and Moshe was. But if your life is going to come to an end, what makes us feel immortalized is to know, bless you, that what we value is being carried on by the next generation. Unlike the Woody Allen joke where he says, I want to reach immortality, but not through dying. So, not through my work, but through not dying. So, we don't really have that option of not dying. So, the second best thing is to leave a legacy and to transmit it to the next generation. Elisa.
This Mount, is that also Mount
Ebal? I don't believe so, but I don't know. That's a very great question, everybody. It may be, because he was going to die up there, but maybe not, because that was going to be, I don't know, I shouldn't answer, I don't know. It may be that it was called that for the purposes of this situation, because things take on a different names based on what's going to happen there. So it's very possible that it was Mount Nebo as well. But we know this doesn't happen at this point. This is going to happen at the very end of the Torah, because now Moshe is very much alive. We still have the rest of the months to go, in the last month of Moshe's life for the book of Devarim before he passes away. But since we're in the Parsha, literally in the Parsha of Pinchas, and everybody is getting their legacy, this piece is brought forward here to let us know that Moshe is not left out of the legacy, that we have the Kohanim are established, Pinchas is established, the families are established, the daughters of Zelophehad are established, and you're not going to have that Moshe is left out literally in the cold on this, and that he is brought in also with perhaps the most important legacy of all, which is to carry on the mission. You can have family, they don't necessarily carry on what you taught them. In fact, you wonder, like, were you not listening to what I was trying to teach you this whole time? So that's no guarantee. Families don't necessarily carry on. And having land in a holy place doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to live up to the standards that the land brings us to. It doesn't necessarily mean that. The person who actually had the longest lasting meaningful inheritance was Moshe, because the transmission from Moshe to Joshua was then to all of the leaders, and we have an unbroken chain of the transmission of Torah from Moshe down to today. So it's like, who had the longest lasting legacy? You can say we have the Kohanim also, but that has gotten a little muddled with different people's marriages and things like that. It's not necessarily so clear. That's the second best, is the Kohanim. But the things that don't have to do with the tangible property, the tangible things, we think tangible is like, I want a piece of the earth. That's like a secure thing. It's like, no, the most secure thing is the spiritual transmission. And that was Moshe and the Kohanim. And that's what has come down to us through all of these ages. So, yes, we should give our children and our loved ones possessions that are meaningful. That's great. What's more meaningful is to make sure that we are transmitting our heritage to them, and we are transmitting our values and our life, and so that they too can be a part of the Masorah. And whether those are our blood relatives or whether they are people who we can influence, those people become our legacy. God willing, we'll have a legacy that is beautiful, bright, and is successful on all fronts. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you.